Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. As today, we're going to talk about the management of chronic lymphocytic leukemia with Dr. Jennifer Woyak from the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center. We have a bunch of other faculty members who took a survey of the usual treatment practices, and we'll show you the results of that in a second. This is the last of the three-part series, and we had to redo our survey for this last part because of some new data that we're going to talk about. Today, we're here to talk about chronic lymphocytic leukemia, a lot about what just happened at the ASH meeting. And as is always the case, we will be talking about the use of unapproved agents and regimens. So please refer to the official prescribing information for each product for the approved indications. As we do with a lot of our meetings, we do with this Meet the Professor series, we went out to a bunch of community-based general medical oncologists and asked them what are some about some cases they could present and questions they'd like to hear addressed, and you'll see those throughout this meeting. Here are the topics we're going to talk about. We're going to begin with the big story of this year and big story in general in CLL, the presentation at ASH of the Phase 3 AMPLIFY study, and we'll talk about trials like AMPLIFY using BTK inhibitors and venetoclax. Then we'll talk about the use of pirtobrutinib, the non-covalent BTK inhibitor. We'll get into a little bit about choice of BTK inhibitors, particularly also the issue of cardiotoxicity of BTKIs, and then a bunch of other associated issues, including transform or Richter's transformation of CLL. But to sort of get into the issue of first-line therapy, and particularly in younger patients, we have this patient. And Jennifer, I want you to think about this patient and tell me if you had seen this patient a month previously when the patient first presented, what you might have recommended if you had access to, for example, an AMPLIFY-like approach. And then what would you do as a second opinion? Because I talked to Dr. Rupart a month after he started treatment. If the patient came to you for a second opinion, I thought we could use this as a way to get into AMPLIFY. Here's the case.
When I saw him during that first visit, Neil, he had visible lymphadenopathy, and you can see the lymph nodes. You can almost make out the bumps of the individual lymph nodes there. So, of course, sent him for flow cytometry, which showed that he had chronic lymphocytic leukemia. After discussion with him, he decided that he wanted to get on treatment, and I started him on acalabrutinib just a month ago, and he has tolerated it very well. He reports a very mild headache, a dramatic, you know, really nice early response to treatment. And I think you can see that in these pictures. 8 days later, he came back to my clinic, and that base of neck lymph node had resolved. It just, you know, it was palpable to me, but there was almost nothing there. For CLL, I feel like anybody 60 or younger is really pretty young for this disease. I'm curious if your faculty members have a preferred approach, or do they base it just upon what is good for the patient's lifestyle and what the patient's preference is? Is it inevitable that Bruton kinase inhibitor resistance will develop? I'm amazed. I have yet to have anyone develop clinically significant resistance to BTK inhibitors on my watch. I know that it happens. I'm also curious as to the prognosis for African-American patients with chronic lymphocytic leukemia.
So a lot to unpack there, particularly the issue of optimal first-line therapy. But before we get into that, just kind of curious about one of his last questions there about seeing progression on BTK inhibitors. How often do you actually see that clinically?
Well, you know, I think if you treat the patients long enough, you definitely are going to see this. In the frontline setting, we know with ibrutinib, obviously the first-in-class BTK inhibitor, the average remission duration is about 9 years. And again, that actually includes people who came off the drug for toxicity, which was a lot. We expect with acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib, it'll probably be pretty similar. So as long as your patients are staying on the drug, you're probably not going to see resistance except for, you know, a handful of people with very high genomic risk disease. In the relapse setting, it happens earlier, but, generally people can be treated for 4 to 6 years, even in the relapse setting.
So let's talk about the data that just got presented. And first, actually, you and your colleague, Dr. Rogers, wrote a paper, and actually you did a presentation at the ASH meeting on the issue of frontline treatment, particularly the issue of triplets or doublets. This is a fantastic paper. It has so many great references and very comprehensive, except it was 1 hour before the Amplify data. So you couldn't talk about that. And so your whole paper became outdated an hour later.
Yeah.
But in any event, I would refer the audience to that presentation because it was really a great review. And then earlier this year, you had a commentary in the New England Journal with the CLL, I think it was 13 study that was presented with the ibrutinib triplet. And it was interesting that in your conclusion there, you talk about the fact that while the data was interesting, people were really looking forward to seeing the second generation covalent inhibitors such as Acala and Zanu with venetoclax. And as of a month ago, now we've seen it. So let's talk a little bit about the phase 3 Amplify study, looking at acalabrutinib plus venetoclax with or without obinutuzumab versus chemo immunotherapy. Anything you want to say about the eligibility? Of course, a big thing here was they didn't take high-risk patients. Anything you want to say about eligibility and the design of the study?
Yeah, so I mean, you're exactly correct. I think the big thing is it does not include people who have 17p deletion. The study is set up to compare the two experimental arms individually to the chemotherapy arm. So probably just like we saw with Elevate TN, at some point we'll see a post hoc analysis comparing AV and AVO. But right now we're really looking at AV versus chemotherapy and AVO versus chemotherapy.
Can you comment on this, progression-free survival?
Yep. So both AV and AVO had superior progression-free survival to chemotherapy. You can see numerically, it looks like AVO has a higher PFS rate at 36 months, 83 versus 76%. When we dig a little deeper, we see that the IGHV unmutated patients is where you kind of see the biggest difference between AV and AVO. So with these IGHV unmutated people, so these are people who also with VO have a shorter progression-free survival than the IGHV mutated patients. Here, though, it looks like the patients with IGHV unmutated disease treated with AVO did extremely well. And I think this is something we're going to want to continue to watch and look at in some of the other triplet studies too.
What about MRD?
So this is something actually that I think was surprising to a lot of us. So if you look at the AVO, the MRD undetectable rates are extremely high. If you look at AV, which is in the blue there, the MRD undetectable rates are actually very much lower than one might expect, and lower than what you tend to see with venetoclax and obinutuzumab. And I think we'll have to see when we look further out from this study whether this lack of, or that patients having more detectable MRD is going to lead to shorter PFS than we might hope.
Of course, survival is always a challenge in CLL, particularly at these early points. Anything you want to say about what we're seeing at this point?
Yeah, I think that the big takeaway here is that there was a lot of COVID deaths in this study. Most of the deaths, I think, at this point were COVID deaths, and there was an imbalance, so twice as many COVID deaths on AVO than AV. So it's actually, I think, really interesting that even with this, you still see that AVO looks like it has a longer PFS or a higher rate of PFS at this time point than AV.
What about in terms of tolerability? Any surprises?
I think just again, like there is more toxicity with AVO than with AV. You see more neutropenia, so neutropenia kind of approaching what you're seeing with the chemotherapy-treated patients. You see more significant infections. It's hard to say, like with the atrial fibrillation and ventricular arrhythmias, definitely there's more with the acalabrutinib arms than with chemotherapy. It's a pretty short period of time, and these are very small numbers of patients, so it's hard to say, you know, how much of an extra risk it's giving.
So as we mentioned, the Amplify study didn't include P53, but there was another data set presented at the ASH meeting, a phase 2 study of AVO, and this included quite a few patients with del-cel NTP at T53. Any thoughts about this one-arm study?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting study. It's from the Dana-Farber Cancer Center. They accrued like an initial cohort and then only people who had TP53 altered CLL. So that's how you're getting so many patients with 17p deletion or TP53 mutation. And it's looking, I think, really good for those high-risk patients. So four-year PFS of 70% in those TP53 altered patients, which, again, for like a regimen where many of the patients were getting a fixed duration treatment, I think it looks really good. In this study, they did allow people to continue the acalabrutinib. So it's, I think, a little bit still hard to say, like, for a pure fixed duration regimen, how are the TP53 altered patients going to do?
So naturally, it's natural to be looking at other. Here's another thing, the paper at Fermatch that your group presented. Again, looking at AVO, but here I think the V was delayed.
Yep. So in this study, we're trying to answer the question, like, is delaying the combination better than giving the combination up front? Is it better tolerated? Or since you have very little disease remaining at a later time point, might it be even more effective? So we're treating people with acalabrutinib for a year and then randomizing them to add either Oben or venetoclax with the kind of the secondary question is one of those versus the other going to be better for getting people into those MRD undetectable states?
So I guess Amplify is the first phase 3 study looking at non-covalent or newer generation, but there are data, for example, zanubrutinib is not a phase 3 study, but one of the arms of the Sequoia study looking at zanu, venetoclax, something that I know is also being looked at in phase 3. Any thoughts, though, about what they saw here?
Yeah, so this is zanubrutinib plus venetoclax, but the zanubrutinib actually continues, so it's not really a fixed duration, but it is showing us that you can get these high-risk patients into deep remission with zanubrutinib plus venetoclax. And so far, for the short period of time it's been ongoing, the durability looks very good, too.
Of course, there you don't have the advantage of being able to stop. Also, naturally, everybody's asking about first-line pirtobrutinib. We'll get to pirtobrutinib in a second, but it's interesting to see this MD Anderson study looking pirtobrutinib, venetoclax, and obinutuzumab first-line. Any thoughts about this one-arm study?
Yeah, so this I think is a really exciting trial. It's looking at PIRT on the front line, as you said, with the idea that it's better tolerated potentially than the covalent BTK inhibitors, so it might be easier to combine. One thing they saw, very, very high rates of undetectable MRD, I think higher than we actually would have expected given the data we see from other studies. So I think, it's going to be really interesting to see this study long-term and how that translates into the PFS.
So, and then there's actually venetoclax is not the only BCL2 inhibitor. You have sonrotoclax, which also is being combined with zanubrutinib. Again, just one arm. What's the difference clinically between venetoclax and sonrotoclax? And any thoughts about this combination?
Yes, so sonrotoclax is actually active in settings of venetoclax resistance. It overcomes some of the resistance mutations we see with venetoclax. There also, I don't know, there's maybe some hints that it may have lowered cytopenias, although I think that we're not entirely sure about that, but it looks very good in this combination, a very high rates of undetectable MRD, very high response rates, as you can see. And this trial is pretty early on, but I think, people have been doing extremely well in the short period of time they've been on it.
Same issues with TLS as venetoclax?
Yep. So it can cause TLS. And I think, luckily, they had the knowledge that that was going to be a side effect, so we're able to generate ramp-ups from the very beginning, so you didn't really see a lot of clinical tumor lysis at all, and though you might have expected you would if you had just gone to the higher doses right away.
So here's an ongoing phase 3 trial that should be very interesting when it matures, venetoclax obin versus zanubrutinib sonrotoclax. Let's our way of doing consensus conferences is we ask a bunch of people what they do, and if they all do the same thing, we call it a consensus. If they have different approaches, well, that's where we come in. And so we said we had to go back to our faculty after Amplify and ask them a bunch of questions about how it was going to affect their practice. And you can check these out. All the slides are in the chat room. But one question we had was, have they already done it? Have they tried this strategy of using a BTK inhibitor and with venetoclax? And most people see either they have or they would. And I guess now with the amplified data, maybe even more so. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can see that people are excited about this regimen. Generally, I think people are choosing it and those that they would otherwise give venetoclax or obinutuzumab to, definitely people who would like the convenience of the all-oral regimen.
So we also asked about if they were, the faculty, if you're going to do BTK combined with venetoclax, whether or not you use CD20 antibody or not, would you have a preferred BTK inhibitor? I assumed everybody would say acalabrutinib because that's where we have the data. A couple of people said zanubrutinib. Any thoughts about that one?
Yeah, I mean, I think the data really exists more with acalabrutinib, although there have been studies of zanubrutinib with like venetoclax obinutuzumab, the Bovin study, and obviously it's being investigated in the phase 3 setting, and some people like zanubrutinib better.
So we wanted to know, okay, are there situations right now where you would like to use an amplify type strategy of BTK, acalabrutinib plus venetoclax with or without anti-CD20? Some people say any patient without del-17P, others prefer it in specific clinical situations. How are you thinking it through right now?
Yeah, so I would consider AV and anybody I was thinking about VO. Probably I would lean towards AV and that even better genomic risk patients just because of that lower rate of undetectable MRD. I would consider AVO for a patient with IGHV unmutated CLL who is young and fit, and I'm not as worried about those infections and other toxicities.
And we also asked specifically what the kind of situations people would be comfortable, particularly using the triplet. And as you just said, you and your paper and then your commentary in New England Journal, I thought was interesting because it focused more on young and fit patients, but yet you would think even older people might be interested in time-limited therapy. What about this patient that you saw presented, a 46-year-old man? First of all, if you know, would you have thought about AVO if you could have given or AV to begin with? And if he were to come to you for a second opinion now, he's been on acalabrutinib for a month, would you flip him into an amplify strategy?
Mm-hmm. So I don't recall if we saw the IGHV mutation status on that patient. I know we saw that he didn't have a TP53 alteration. I think, you know, acalabrutinib by itself is absolutely a great regimen. And, you know, if this is somebody who is committed to receiving a long duration of therapy, I would not mess with something that seems to be working and he's tolerating. There are studies right now looking at consolidation with venetoclax or other agents. And so I would probably talk, that's what I would probably focus on is like talking about, you know, would you be interested in a trial at some point where we'd add something to the acalabrutinib to try to get you off treatment? And for some people are very interested in that. Some people say, hey, I'm tolerating this just fine. I don't really want to do anything else. And that would be just fine too.
Do you think that young people in general are more interested in time-limited therapy than older people?
Not necessarily. I think for this, one of the reasons that people say young and fit is with the Alliance AO4-1702 study, which was IVO versus IO. IVO was met its futility endpoint because IVO was not better than IO, and there was a lot more COVID deaths and a lot more toxicity. And again, with AVO, there's more toxicity than with AV. So I think just thinking like who's going to really tolerate this well, I think that the big thing for young versus old is how many years of life versus how many years worth of therapy do we have to offer somebody? And so if you have the chance to do a 1-year treatment and give them hopefully many years off therapy with the potential of using it again, I think that's a strategy that's pretty appealing to both physicians and patients.
You mentioned earlier venetoclax or resistance mutations to venetoclax. Do you see that when you use it only, you know, for a year in a time-limited fashion? Is it more in the people who get it longer term?
Yeah, generally it's in people who have taken venetoclax for at least 2 years, because we saw it really when we were giving venetoclax continuously in those very highly refractory patients. We may start to see them if we're giving venetoclax repeatedly, even it, you know, if you give venoban and then 4 years later give venoban again. I mean, my guess is eventually you'll start to see these mutations arise.
So Dr. Rupert, the final question was whether we know anything about CLL in Black patients and African-American patients, which this 46-year-old man was. And I saw you had a couple of papers trying to begin to look at this question. What did you come up with?
Yeah, so, you know, I think this is a really important question. And, you know, there are many fewer African-Americans with CLL than there are white patients. And so it's a group that has not been traditionally like looked at very closely. These two papers, we were using SEER databases, like large scale databases, which don't have a lot of granularity of data. In the first one, where we didn't have access to see what types of therapies they were getting, we saw that Black patients did have poorer outcomes compared to white patients. When we were able then to look at whether people had access or were given BTK inhibitors or novel therapies, that discrepancy actually went away, which I think is telling us that, you know, these drugs are very good. There's some data previously showing that Black patients tend to be diagnosed earlier and have higher genomic risk disease. This was older data, so probably needs to be repeated. But maybe it's that if you're not giving people with higher genomic risk disease BTK inhibitors, they don't do as well. But if you do, they do a little bit better. But I think this is really an area where we need to do some more work.
Next topic is pirtobrutinib. And, you know, despite looking, I've yet to find one of the community-based oncologists who's actually used pirtobrutinib. But I did ask them about it, and particularly what they would like to hear about it. And here's what Dr. Lamar had to say.
Pirtobrutinib has been reported to be useful in other BTK failures. And I really just wondered, are the investigators seeing that that's really true? And would they consider a pirtobrutinib, you know, in someone who's had a BTK progression?
Have you ever used pirtobrutinib?
I have not. I've heard mixed things about it. I've heard some people who say that, you know, this is the greatest drug. Somebody described it as the LeBron James of BTK inhibitors. And so that stood out to me. I've had other people who say, you know what? I've used it. I haven't seen it work well in people who've been on BTK inhibitors before.
Anything you want to hear them talk about in terms of pirtobrutinib?
I think the biggest thing for me is the side effect profiles. I mean, in the course of the day, I see so much, you know, from glioblastoma to lung cancer to sarcoma to factor V Leiden variants. So just really trying to quickly understand the things we should be most concerned about. Of course, you know, we always look up the drugs and look up the side effects, but sometimes the things that are most important don't always stand out when you're going through the drug list.
That's our target audience right there. And we like to cut to the chase to try to help them out as much as possible. I love the sports analogy. I was asking you whether you're going to be rooting for Ohio State tomorrow night, but I didn't realize you're also a graduate of Notre Dame. So maybe the two of them will face off for the national championship. But let's talk a little bit about pirtobrutinib. This is from our survey. And we ask people in general what their third-line therapy is or what their usual therapy is with the double refractory patients. Most people say pirtobrutinib, and most people say they use it in the third line. What about, you know, again, it's one thing to read papers or list the side effects, but have you seen useful responses to patients who progressed on prior BTK? We know people who aren't tolerant of BTK. What about people who progressed?
Yeah, I mean, that is the cohort of patients that was studied primarily in the Bruin study, which is what led to the accelerated FDA approval. It has over an 80% response rate in people who had taken a prior covalent BTK inhibitor. The median progression-free survival is only about a year and a half or so. It's a little bit longer in people who had not had venetoclax, a little shorter in people who had previously been treated with venetoclax. But it is absolutely effective in that third-line therapy setting.
We also asked about their perception. And again, you know, in terms of efficacy versus tolerability, it's one thing to try to read papers. It's another thing just to go, you know, we base everything on rounds, you know, like just asking people what they think. So we were comparing pirtobrutinib to the other BTK inhibitors, particularly the second generation covalent, in terms of whether they're more effective. Most people are saying there's not enough data. What about toxicity? You hear that it's, quote, very well tolerated. Is that something you think you can see in the patients?
Mm-hmm. I think Dr. Lamar made an excellent point, which is when you look at the package insert, or even when you look at a clinical trial, it is really hard to tell, especially in these drugs that are given for a long period of time. Because, you know, a common toxicity like an upper respiratory infection, if you follow people for 3 years, like probably they're going to get that, or back pain or things like that. I think most of us who have given covalent BTK inhibitors, who have given pirtobrutinib, think that pirtobrutinib has less toxicity than the covalent BTK inhibitor. And it is generally extremely well tolerated. I think the only side effect that is different than what we see with the covalent BTK inhibitors is there might be a little bit more neutropenia. Again, this is in like a more heavily pretreated patient population, and we don't see a lot of infections associated with it, but that's something I just watch out for initially. Other than that, like, you know, you can see some bruising. It generally is less than what you see with the covalent BTK inhibitors.
So Dr. Kumar in the chat room says, quote, does this mean ven-obin is out now and we should just use BTK or BTK with ven in all patients? Is ven-obin still in?
Yeah, I think ven-obin is still in. And technically, the approval for pirtobrutinib is in people who have had two prior therapies, including both a BTK inhibitor and venetoclax-based therapy. I think there are people who are very interested in using that strategy of just a covalent and then a non-covalent BTK inhibitor, not approved at this time, but is of interest. But venetoclax, obviously, very, very good drug.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the data sets that have come out on pirtobrutinib. This one looking specifically, I guess these are all people, or at least this situation from the phase 1/2 Bruin study, but these are specifically patients who were intolerant of prior BTK. It looks like they did pretty well.
Yep, absolutely. They did, you know, as well as kind of the full patient population. And you didn't see a lot of toxicities leading to discontinuation with pirtobrutinib.
And anything you can put your finger on in terms of maybe being better in terms of toxicity-wise, particularly atrial fibrillation? Any reason to think there's going to be less atrial fibrillation than with a Calazanu, for example?
You know, there's some thoughts that CSK inhibition is related to the atrial fibrillation with the BTK inhibitors. I think pirtobrutinib is more selective than any of the covalent BTK inhibitors. So I think there's the potential that any like off-target mediators of atrial fibrillation would be more commonly seen with the second generation inhibitors than pirtobrutinib.
So there's been a lot of interest in resistance mutations that occur with our first generation agents. This is a paper looking at resistance mutations on pirtobrutinib. What do we know about what you see there?
Mm-hmm. So it's similar to the covalent BTK inhibitors. You do see primarily BTK mutations leading to resistance with pirtobrutinib. They are different mutations. So the C41S mutation, which mediates resistance to ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, zanubrutinib, pirtobrutinib works in that setting. Primarily what we see with pirtobrutinib resistance are these so-called gatekeeper mutations, primarily T474 is the site, and then kinase dead mutations. So ones that actually make the BTK kinase inactive. L528W is the most common one that is seen. Interestingly, it looks like, at least in this Bruin population, a lot of the patients actually have these mutations at baseline at low allelic frequencies that sort of grow out during the course of pirtobrutinib treatment, which raises the question, like if you're looking at people who have not had a covalent BTK inhibitor, which is, you know, they're doing frontline studies right now, maybe you're going to not see resistance developing so quickly.
So we know there's a bunch of phase 3 studies looking at pirtobrutinib. This is one of the first, or maybe the first, that's been presented just at the ASH meeting. This compares it to adalimumab plus rituximab or BR in pretreated CLL. Any thoughts about what they saw there and was what was reported?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that the primary question of pirtobrutinib versus Idela R or VR is not super interesting. And of course, pirtobrutinib was better. You know, interestingly, the median progression-free survival is 14 months, which is actually relatively similar to what was seen in the Bruin study, though the population actually is pretty similar to what was studied in the Bruin trial. I think one of the most interesting things that we saw here is that there is a big discrepancy between the progression-free survival and actually the time to next treatment. So in a clinical trial like this, the patients were getting routine CAT scans like every 3 months or so. And so clinical or so disease progression was picked up very early. And the trial allowed patients to stay on the drug if they were still deriving clinical benefit. And so there's actually a 10-month difference there between progression and time to next treatment, suggesting that even when you see some clinical progression, it tends to occur slowly and people can get quite a bit more mileage out of the drug.
One other thing I want to just bring up, there are a couple of papers we wanted to mention to you about pirtobrutinib in Transform disease, but we'll get to that a little bit later. We have one of the cases that we're going to present here is a patient who had an issue with bleeding risk. And of course, there's a lot of interest in the question of pirtobrutinib and bleeding. What do we know about that?
So similar to the covalent BTK inhibitor studies, warfarin has been excluded from pirtobrutinib studies, so we don't have really data with warfarin. This was looking at people who were on the Bruin study who were also on some sort of other anticoagulation, primarily a DOAC. And it showed that the bleeding, like bruising and bleeding, was a little bit higher in those patients who were also taking anticoagulants, but not significantly so, and really wasn't therapy limiting. So suggesting that it's pretty, it's safe if you have somebody who does require anticoagulation to also treat them with pirtobrutinib.
So I want to go on now and get a little bit into the issue of choice of first-line BTKI. I was asking you when the last time was you started ibrutinib on a patient. You told me you couldn't remember. So we're really talking about particularly Acala and Zanu. But this is interesting because this is a patient who actually started out on ibrutinib. Here's what happened. It's an 86-year-old woman.
Elderly woman that was diagnosed many years ago. We treated her with ibrutinib, which she tolerated poorly, predominantly with bruising. And it was interesting, a lot of her bruising was on her face. And ultimately, we had to discontinue it, although she was on it for a few years. And despite dose reductions, we actually dose reduced her. She ultimately came off the therapy. And then roughly about a year and a half later, required therapy again due to progressive elevation of her Y count with associated thrombocytopenia. And given her prior issues with ibrutinib toxicity, we started her on acalabrutinib, but I actually started her on a reduced dose of 100 milligrams daily, and she's actually tolerated that extremely well, excellent control of her disease, excellent tolerability. So my questions in this case are, do the clinical investigators ever switch from one BTK inhibitor to another based on different potential side effect profile of different agents, such as what we did in this case? And do they ever use dose reductions to manage side effects, such as excessive bruising?
Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, those are great points. There are data with both acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib in ibrutinib intolerant patients, and some data with zanubrutinib and acalabrutinib intolerant patients. So yes, I mean, to answer the question, it's absolutely appropriate to switch from one BTK inhibitor to another in the setting of toxicity. Depends a little bit on the toxicity that you're seeing. So somebody who had a life-threatening bleed, I might not switch them to another BTK inhibitor. The rate of serious bleeding is pretty similar among the three. A life-threatening like ventricular arrhythmia, I probably wouldn't do another BTK inhibitor. But something like this, like bruising or, you know, some other side effect that I would definitely switch, just like Dr. Brenner did.
So we also asked our faculty about their preference between the two drugs. Some people, as we always see this, some people prefer one versus the other. Most people think that both are, you know, essentially equivalent. And some people, you know, bring up, as you bring up, the issue of maybe somebody with problematic hypertension being favoring Acala, somebody with headaches maybe favoring Zanu. Anything you want to say about choice?
I think these two drugs are much more alike than they are different. And it is sort of nitpicking when people say like, oh, you know, I would use it for this patient and I would use this for another patient. But if you have to choose, I mean, those are where, those are the places that you can choose. I think otherwise there is probably more data in 17p deleted for zanubrutinib. That doesn't mean it's better. It's just there's more data.
Yeah, this comes up all the time in oncology, CDK inhibitors, where there are three CDKs in breast cancer, and so hard to figure this out when you don't have direct comparisons. Okay, so let's get into the issue of BTKIs and the heart. We actually have two cases, a lot of cases people bring up of patients with cardiac issues. This is a patient with a very common situation. We hear a lot of questions about a patient who already has atrial fibrillation before they get treated. This is a 72-year-old man, a patient of Dr. Battinger.
72-year-old guy who previously had bladder cancer and chronic atrial fibrillation, for which he is on long-term anticoagulation. He originally had a deletion 13q, but has now acquired a deletion 17p, also found to have an IGVH that was unmutated, and given his atrial fibrillation, was recommended to receive venetoclax and obinutuzumab, which he successfully completed 6 cycles and 1 year of venetoclax maintenance and is now doing extremely well. All of his symptoms are resolved. His blood counts look perfect. And actually, his MRD testing was negative. And so my questions about this case are, you know, to what degree does the presence of atrial fibrillation in CLL patients contribute to your decision-making regarding frontline therapy, and whether you consider baseline atrial fibrillation to be an absolute contraindication to BTK inhibitions? And if not, how do you work with your cardiology colleagues to monitor these patients? I think there's a little bit of anxiety about like exacerbating their atrial fibrillation since the drug can do that as well.
So, and of course, a corollary here, because this patient had del 17p, is how much are you thinking about BTK inhibitor in a patient with high risk disease? You know, usually we ask investigators, they prefer BTK, but what about a patient like this with prior AFib? And interesting, he did so great, at least initially, on the venetoclax obinutuzumab. But any thoughts about management of patients who already have AFib?
Mm-hmm. So AFib is not an absolute contraindication to using a BTK inhibitor, specifically acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib. You know, as mentioned, I would send these patients to see one of my cardiology colleagues before and to kind of monitor them during the course of therapy. Sometimes they'll do more extensive like Holter monitors and things like that. When we looked at our patients at Ohio State treated with ibrutinib specifically, one of the only the risk factors we could find for ventricular arrhythmias was actually people who had developed atrial fibrillation on the BTK inhibitor. So if all things being equal, I would not choose a BTK inhibitor in somebody who had atrial fibrillation. In a case like this, somebody who has high-risk disease, even in the frontline setting, I would consider still using a BTK inhibitor and just watching them closely.
So here's another cardiac case. This is a 74-year-old man with really bad congestive heart failure, ejection fraction 20-25%, multiple admissions for congestive heart failure, but he also required treatment. Here's Dr. Matt Amaral.
This patient is a 74-year-old male who originally presented with ARISE stage 0 CLL. He's been on observation since 2014. He does have a terrible, structurally unsound heart. So when he started to have white blood cell counts in the 100,000 range and developed really bad lymphocytosis, splenomegaly, and some other symptoms from CLL, I did have to speak to his cardiologist about offering him options. I was not sure that this patient was ever going to tolerate a BTK inhibitor. He was not very interested in having to come in for IV infusions. I'm sort of at the mercy with his cardiologist here as well. He really has something that needed more of a quick fix, if that makes sense. The lymphadenopathy underneath his arm is now turning colors. So we needed something that was a little bit quicker. That lymph node was really causing him a lot of issues.
I left out the part where she says, what about BR? But anyhow, what about a patient like this with really bad congestive heart failure? And you heard the other, in fact, he really needs treatment as well.
Yeah, so congestive heart failure is also not a contraindication to treatment with a BTK inhibitor, though, of course, I mean, you always worry about making their heart failure worse if they were to develop atrial fibrillation, if, you know, the hypertension gets worse, things like that. But, you know, in somebody who, like, otherwise needs a BTK inhibitor, I would certainly use one. And again, just kind of monitor closely and work with my cardiology colleagues to make sure that they weren't having any side effects that we weren't managing appropriately.
So I was really curious to see, you have so many great publications in general, but you have a number looking, some review like this paper here, looking at cardiovascular toxicities and, the cardio-oncology state-of-the-art review and reviewing all the issues that are seen. Also, another specific paper in leukemia looking at atrial fibrillation. These are all for the audience. And then something I had never heard of before, pericardial events with ibrutinib. I didn't even know that occurred. Any sort of, there were a million teaching points, but anything you'd like to pick out? Any comments about, have you seen patients with clinically significant pericardial effusions?
Yeah, so I have actually, and this paper actually comes from the Alliance AO412 study, AO412-02, and the ECOG 1912 study. So those were kind of the original ibrutinib versus chemotherapy studies. And, you know, it's something that you're not going to notice unless you are looking at a very large clinical trial. But we saw about a 2% risk of pericardial events, and that could be pericardial effusions, even up to tamponade. So definitely they were higher in the ibrutinib arms than the chemotherapy arms. Very rare complication, but something if you see, like you, I think, should know that it can be related to the BTK inhibitor.
So more back to our docs, and I can always count on Dr. Rupar to bring up something that I haven't thought too much about, but maybe we ought to think about more. This is a 61-year-old man who wanted to get time-limited therapy, so he started obinutuzumab venetoclax, and as many patients did, he had a pretty significant infusion reaction to obinutuzumab, and that's what Dr. Rupar would like to hear feedback on.
This patient had, as most patients do, the typical infusion reaction. I think this is almost universally, in my experience, called the shakes and bakes. He got the obinutuzumab, and within, you know, 5 minutes of that initial infusion, which was going at a very low rate, he had some low-grade fevers, you know, low 100.0, 100.2 kind of fevers, but symptomatic to him. And he felt cold and started shivering, and really he looked like he was rigoring. And I'm sure your faculty members deal with this all the time. This can be a very scary thing for infusion nurses, particularly in my practice. We have about half and half oncology certified and non-oncology certified infusion nurses. And those who have a little less experience see this and they feel like the patient may be heading towards anaphylaxis, and it makes them pretty nervous. So I often get paged out to the infusion room, you know, while I'm in the middle of another appointment. I'm curious how your faculty members deal with this issue, both on a practical level with the infusion nurses. Is it just a matter of education in advance? Or is there something that we could do as clinicians, any tricks that you have up your sleeve that reduce the likelihood of having the reactions that go from looking pretty minor to, in the eyes of the infusion nurses, looking more serious and they get a little closer to that EpiPen?
So any thoughts, particularly, you know, we have a lot of our audience is new to oncology, oncology fellows, they've been in oncology less than 5 years. Any clinical pearls?
Yeah, so I mean, I completely agree. Dr. Rupert is right. There is a lot of infusion reactions with obinutuzumab. It's interesting. It's different than the pattern of infusion reactions you see with rituximab. So usually with rituximab, you start to see the reactions as you're kind of increasing the speed of the infusion as the rate is getting higher. Whereas with obin, it is usually very quick, like within the first 10 seconds or so, or 10 minutes. I guess, you know, the risk of anaphylaxis is very low. In terms of making the infusion nurses less or more comfortable, I guess just that understanding of the time course that it is actually normal for the infusion reactions to happen so quickly. They usually do resolve with supportive care. And just like with other monoclonal antibodies, you know, the first day can be very rough, and after that, it gets much better. So, you know, with CLL, obinutuzumab, we usually do 100 milligrams the first day, 900 milligrams the second day. And usually even the second day is a walk in the park without infusion reactions, even if you do see some more significant ones on that first day. So again, like, they respond very well to supportive care. They often don't recur when you restart the infusion. In terms of ways to prevent it, I've tried a few different things in terms of like trying to pre-medicate with steroids. I'm not sure that give steroids not just before the infusion, but maybe for a day or so beforehand. And I'm not sure that helps, so I still do it occasionally. One thing that actually really does help is if you give a BTK inhibitor beforehand. So if you were planning on doing an acalabrutinib, venetoclax regimen or something like that, having that BTK inhibitor in the patient's system actually does decrease if you were going to use acalabrutinib, obinutuzumab, as long as you give the acalabrutinib first, you will see lower risk of infusion reactions with the obinutuzumab.
So I've got to ask you, related to this next case, so you're talking about all the, all these papers you've done on cardiac effects with BTK inhibitors. Have you had a cardiologist as a patient?
So I guess yes. I can't recall if I've had a cardiologist patient on a BTK inhibitor.
Well, here's a 63-year-old cardiologist who got started on ibrutinib, was doing great, and then he started to read the cardiology literature and goes to his doc and say, how about you put me on something else? Here's what happened.
This is a 63-year-old cardiologist, very active. He presented with hemolytic anemia that was unresponsive to steroids, and he was ultimately started on ibrutinib. So he's been on ibrutinib for years. No side effects to the medication, doing well on it. But as a cardiologist, he was concerned about the potential cardiovascular side effects and came to me asking my opinion about switching to some of the newer agents. And I said, of course, why not? Let's do it. So I started him on zanubrutinib, and within 2 weeks, the hemolytic anemia returned. And so I started him on a prolonged prednisone taper. Every time we would taper down the steroids, the hemolytic anemia returned. I ultimately gave him rituximab and continued him on zanubrutinib. And eventually, the hemolytic anemia has improved, but it's taken much longer than I thought it would.
Any questions for the faculty?
Generally, in the setting of hemolytic anemia, if it responds to steroids, glucocorticoids, I don't treat the underlying CLL. This gentleman, unfortunately, was unresponsive to both steroids and rituximab. So I would have felt forced to begin CLL treatment for him. And I'm just wondering, am I thinking about this the right way?
So a lot of issues here. One is this case, which really surprised me that he popped up with the hemolytic anemia on zanubrutinib. Kind of curious what your thoughts are about that and whether there's any mechanistic explanation for it.
Yeah, actually, that is really interesting and surprising to me as well. So we know that the BTK inhibitors in general are good at controlling autoimmune complications of CLL, including autoimmune hemolytic anemia. There's more data with ibrutinib and acalabrutinib than zanubrutinib, and I have not had as much experience with zanubrutinib in patients with autoimmune hemolytic anemia, so I can't really, I don't know a mechanistic way and can't speak anecdotally to why zanubrutinib would be different. Ibrutinib does have more T-cell effects. Like, I don't know why that would make a big difference in this case, but I suppose maybe there was something about the ibrutinib that really was controlling the hemolytic anemia that zanubrutinib just wasn't hitting.
What about her more global question about the management of patients with CLL with autoimmune complications like hemolytic anemia, and when to treat the CLL and when to just go with steroids plus or minus rituximab?
So, I mean, that strategy is exactly appropriate. So in somebody who otherwise does not meet criteria to initiate therapy for CLL, if they develop hemolytic anemia or ITP, you treat the autoimmune complication and you don't treat the underlying CLL unless they are unresponsive to the standard therapies of steroids, rituximab, and then, you know, in the setting of ITP, like I would usually use Nplate or something like that as well.
So whenever we do with these programs where we have videos from the docs in practice, I always like to joke that Dr. Brenner is usually the cognitive memory test. So you should either pull out a pen because he's going to fire out a whole bunch of questions, or let's see if you can remember them all. But here are a bunch of questions he threw out to me about general issues in CLL.
We know that in the modern era, we have an effective vaccine for COVID-19, but we still have many patients who are fearful of receiving multiple COVID-19 vaccinations. My question for the clinical investigators is, how important do they think vaccination is for COVID-19? And is BTK inhibitor therapy by itself a risk factor for a higher risk of COVID-19 related morbidity and even mortality? Also, what is the role of MRD testing to make management decisions in the community setting? And is it ready for prime time? Are they using flow cytometry? Are they using next generation sequencing? Are they doing it just on the peripheral blood? And how do we use MRD testing in a community setting to potentially make any management decisions, such as stopping therapy after a period of time in patients who are potentially long-term MRD negative? Do they usually use a CD20 monoclonal antibody to cytoreduce an elevated white cell count prior to initiation of venetoclax to lower risk of tumor lysis syndrome? And do the clinical investigators believe that obinutuzumab is a more effective CD20 monoclonal antibody in CLL? And should we use it rather than rituximab, both in the frontline and the relapse setting? In patients who we've cytoreduced to a CD20 monoclonal antibody, do the clinical investigators still use the standard slow ramp-up phase over 5 weeks, or can we go to the full dose from the beginning in patients who have low white counts and no bulky lymphadenopathy or splenomegaly?
All right, go for it. That's about a dozen questions here.
Oh, I thought you were writing it down for me.
All right, okay. Let's start out with COVID vaccination. Yeah. And also, there were a lot of deaths in Amplify from COVID. I think like half the deaths were from COVID. I guess it was during the pandemic they were doing the trial.
Yeah. So, you know, definitely we still do see patients with CLL dying of COVID, although much less frequently than at the height of the pandemic. It is very consistent across the literature that vaccinations prevent COVID-related deaths, including in people with CLL. So I encourage all my CLL patients, even those who don't think or know that they don't mount a good antibody response, to still get COVID vaccinations. We know that there are potentially some like T-cell effects from the COVID vaccines too. There's still a lot of unknowns there, but I think for the most part, the benefit of the COVID vaccines outweighs the risks for most patients. I think then the next question regarding COVID was whether BTK inhibitors make COVID worse. And I think actually exactly the opposite is true. So there was definitely some data earlier in the pandemic suggesting, first retrospectively and then some even prospectively, that BTK inhibitors, ibrutinib and acalabrutinib, may actually decrease the risk of the severe kind of like the lung fibrosis from COVID because of the inability to recruit some of the inflammatory proteins, so you get less like fibrosis and scarring. This is not borne out in phase 3 trials that being on a BTK inhibitor reduces the risk of death from COVID. But I think it certainly doesn't make it worse. And I think probably for some patients, it does make it better.
What about MRD?
Yeah, so MRD, I think this is a great question. And I think that there is going to be a role for MRD testing in the community in the future. Right now, MRD is primarily used to establish prognosis and not guide therapy. And so, you know, I think it is a helpful tool, like at the end of a venetoclax obinutuzumab or something like that, to check MRD just to be able to educate the patient. Like, yes, you're likely to have a very long remission duration. Unfortunately, you're likely to have the CLL come back in a shorter period of time because you still have MRD present. Especially in the frontline setting, I never would adjust the duration of therapy because of MRD. Now, this is something that is being investigated in clinical trials, so could be different in the future.
What about anti-CD20? Do you use rituximab in the second line setting or obinutuzumab? Mm-hmm.
So there are two trials now. One was with chlorambucil as the partner, and then the CLL13 study, which was venetoclax with the partner, that had arms with rituximab and arms with obinutuzumab that both suggest that obinutuzumab is better in CLL than rituximab. So the more relevant one is the CLL13 study, where there was a cohort with venetoclax rituximab, a cohort with venetoclax obinutuzumab. Both were compared to chemoimmunotherapy with either FCR or BR. And while VO improved progression-free survival over chemotherapy, VR did not. The two arms were not directly compared, but I think you can extrapolate from that obinutuzumab for CLL patients, at least in the frontline setting, is a better combination partner. And I think that, you know, that data can be pretty easily extrapolated to the relapse setting as well.
Here's some work you did looking at COVID vaccinations and patients. Also, we'll talk later if we get to transformed disease, the use of monoclonal bispecifics, particularly epcoritamab, which we saw at the ASH meeting a couple of papers on, looking pretty encouraging. But I got to come back to another patient of Dr. Rupard. He has an interesting part of his practice are Amish people who come to his clinic in a horse and buggy. And they pay cash. So here's one of those patients and what happened and a question related to that.
This gentleman is a member of what we call the plain community. He is Amish and he pays out of pocket for these drugs. And the ibrutinib is less expensive, I found, than some of the other CLL medications, but still fairly costly. So when he got his first bottle of ibrutinib, he decided on his own without talking to me or anyone about it, that he would just take one pill a day rather than three pills a day. Wow. And ended up just taking 140 milligrams daily. And when I saw him afterward, he was very insistent that he wanted to see what the 140 milligrams would do for him and for his white blood cell count. And indeed, his white blood cell count improved fairly dramatically, and his hemoglobin and platelets were normal, and he was entirely asymptomatic with regards to the CLL. So the question for your faculty is a fairly obvious one. Is it acceptable to use a lower dose of bruton kinase inhibitor than is suggested by the original trials, or is that a no-no? Is that conducive to the cancer of developing future resistant to these bruton kinase inhibitor drugs?
And sort of a corollary question I have is, you know, I hear about the fact that there are a fair number of people in the United States who get chemotherapy first line for CLL. And then, you know, a lot of people sort of think this is because of the docs not keeping up to date, which is kind of hard to believe. And I wonder whether there might be a lot of situations where finances are maybe driving that decision. But first, any thoughts about his question of can you get away? Is there any downside to using a low dose like that?
So, you know, I think that there is a downside to using a low dose. So we know from the clinical trials, 140 milligrams of ibrutinib should work for a period of time. When you have lower doses, though, the BTK occupancy is much more variable, and you probably have more times when the BTK is not fully occupied. And I do believe that that is going to put people at risk for developing resistance eventually. So while it might be fine initially, I do worry that the remission duration is going to be shorter. I think, you know, this is a really good case for why fixed duration regimens are very important in CLL because, you know, even though the upfront cost with two drugs is going to be more expensive than with just one, like if you could do 1 year of therapy and then stop it, ultimately is going to be much more cost effective.
That's a really great point. So one final question. I knew we weren't going to get to this, but I want to ask you about it because we kind of brought it up earlier. we were talking about pirtobrutinib, and we saw, I think it was last year at ASH, some interesting data suggesting that pirtobrutinib might have activity in transformed disease. And I know that's been published since that point. What's the bottom line in terms of that scenario in pirtobrutinib?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a response rate to all BTK inhibitors with Richter's transformation. Pirtobrutinib may have the highest response rate, and there, I think it's about 50% of people will have a response to pirtobrutinib with Richter's transformation. I think the big takeaway, though, is that it's not a durable remission. So when you're starting somebody on pirtobrutinib for Richter's, you have to be thinking about what's your next strategy after that.
So thank you so much, Jennifer, for working with us today. We could easily spend another hour on this topic, if not more. Audience, thank you for tuning in. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Have a good one.